The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
Listen to the news report about a robbery and then complete the notes from the detective's notebook.
First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 6. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 6.
There has been an armed robbery this morning at the Halifax Building Society's branch in Edward Street. John Brings is at the scene with Detective Sergeant Henry Lawson.
Detective Sergeant, can you tell us what you know about the robbery?
Yes, the raid took place this morning, shortly after 11:30, when a man accompanied by a woman went into the offices of the building society and asked to see the manager. There were no other customers in the building at the time. They were let into the manager's office, and the woman produced a gun from her handbag. Then they took the manager back out of his office and made him tell the cashiers to hand over all the money they had in the tills and in the safe. It came to about $25,000.
Presumably you have a number of witnesses.
Yes, we have a good description of both of them. The man was about 1 meter 80 centimeters, around 35 years of age, with blue eyes and short, curly, red or ginger hair. He was wearing jeans, a green sweater, and a three-quarter-length blue coat. When he spoke to the cashier when he came in, he called himself Mr. Erickson, but we doubt whether that is his real name. But we do know that may be his real name. He also spoke with a strong Scottish accent, which may help us to trace him.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 7 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 7 to 10.
And what about the woman?
Now, she is in her early 20s, slim and quite tall, about 1 metre 70 centimetres. She was wearing a long white raincoat, which was quite loose-fitting, and which she didn't take off. She had a beige handbag, which they used to hide the gun in. She's got straight, shoulder-length blonde hair, blue eyes, and, like the man, has a noticeable accent.
Do you have any other information?
Yes, the car they used was seen by two or three people. It's a blue or dark blue Ford Escort, and we have the registration number. And it's G595ERI. I'll say that again. It's G595ERI. Now, the car was stolen from Bishopstone just over a week ago, so if anyone has seen it in the last week, we would like to hear from them. We also know that the car's front left headlight was broken when it was stolen, and is still broken, we think.
So, you would like information from the public about the car?
Yes, and the people. We're appealing to anyone who thinks they may recognise the two robbers or know anything about the car. We've set up an incident room in Swindon and the telephone number is 774529. So we would like people to ring us if they have any information. And, of course, all calls will be dealt with in the strictest confidence.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the number again, if you have any information, is 774529. And now back to the studio.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a conversation between an IELTS candidate and an IELTS administrator.
First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 15.
Good afternoon. I'm applying for a master's program at the University of Exeter in the UK. I'm planning to register for the IELTS exam at your centre next month. I have some questions I'd like to ask you before I register, if that's okay.
Certainly. Would you be taking the academic module?
I think so, but I'll have to contact the university just to make sure.
You'll probably need the academic because most universities don't accept the general training. And anyway, the procedures to register for the exam are the same for both the general and the academic modules.
Good. My first question is whether I sit all parts of the exam on the same day. I don't live here, you see. And for me, it would be more convenient to do all the papers on the same day.
Unfortunately, the speaking part is scheduled for Thursdays, and reading, writing and listening tests take place on Saturdays. We can't change the days, I'm afraid.
That's a pity. Well, never mind. What sort of documents do I need to bring in order to register?
You'll have to fill in the IELTS application form and bring an ID, a copy of your ID, and two passport-sized photos on a white background.
Will any ID do?
We only accept original passports and national IDs.
That's good to know. Did you say that reading, writing, and listening are scheduled for Saturday?
That's right.
Will I get a break in between the papers?
I'm afraid there aren't any breaks between the papers. Each paper takes an hour to complete, so it's 3 hours straight through. You'll first do listening, and then reading, followed by the writing test. This is a standard requirement from Cambridge.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 16 to 20.
Okay, and how soon after the test can I pick up my results?
It takes 13 calendar days for the results to be processed.
Can you let me know how much it is and the form of payment?
The examination fee is $200. You can pay by credit or debit card. We also accept checks. We only accept cash as a form of payment in exceptional circumstances.
And one last question. Can I mail you the application documents?
Certainly. You can send all the documents by registered mail to our address, 47 Clover Place, New Rochelle, New York.
Could you spell New Rochelle for me, please?
Certainly. NEWROCHELLE.
Could I have the zip code as well?
Sure. Our zip code is 10806.
Thanks.
You can also email us at iinquiry@examsmail.com or phone us at 325-9082.
I think that's all. Thank you very much for all the information. Bye.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part three.
Part three.
You'll hear a discussion between two students, Rosie and Mike, and a university tutor. In the first part of the discussion, they're talking about a survey they have conducted on local entertainment. First, look at questions 21 to 26. Now listen to the first part of the discussion and answer questions 21 to 26.
Good morning, everyone. Well, I think we can start straight away by getting Rosie and Mike to do their presentation. Would you like to start, Rosie?
Yes. Well, we've done a survey on local entertainment. Basically, we tried to find out how students feel about the entertainment in the town and how much they use it.
Yes, so we've called our project Out and About.
Yes, that's a good title, Out and About.
We wanted to find out how well students use the entertainment facilities in town, whether they get to see the latest plays, films, that kind of thing.
Now, we have our own facilities on campus, of course.
Oh, yes. We deliberately omitted those as we really wanted to examine outside entertainment in the town as opposed to on the university campus.
Actually, there were a lot of areas to choose from, but in the end, we limited ourselves to looking at three general categories. Cinema, theatre and music.
Right.
OK, well, first of all, cinema. In the town, there are three main places where you can see films. There's the new multi-screen cinema complex, the old park cinema, and a late-night Odeon.
So, if you look at this chart, in terms of audience size, the multi-screen complex accounts for 75% of all cinema seats. The park cinema accounts for 20% of seats, and the late-night Odeon has just 5% of seats.
As you probably know, the complex and the park show all the latest films, while the late-night cinema tends to show cult films. So, when we interviewed the students, we thought the complex would be the most popular choice of cinema. But surprisingly, it was the late-night Odeon.
Yeah, and most students said that if they wanted to see a new film, they waited for it to show at the park, because the complex is more expensive and further out of town, so you have to pay more to get there as well.
Yes. And that adds to the cost, of course, and detracts from the popularity, evidently.
Well, next, we looked at theatres. The results here were interesting because, as you know, there's a theatre on campus, which is popular, but there's also the stage theatre in town, which is very old and architecturally quite beautiful. And there's the large modern theatre, the Ash Top that has recently been built.
So you just looked at the two theatres in town?
Yes, but the thing about the theatres is that there's a whole variety of seat prices. Also, the types of performance vary. So students tend to buy seats at both and like using both for different reasons. And if they want cheap seats at the Ash Top, they can just sit further from the front.
What we did find that was very interesting is that there are periods during the year when students seem to go to the theatre and periods when they go to the cinema. And we really think that's to do with budget. If you look at this graph, you can see that there's a peak around November, December when they go to the theatre more, and then a period in April, May when neither is particularly popular. And then theatre viewing seems to trail off virtually, while the cinema becomes quite popular in June, July.
I think you're probably right about your conclusions.
In the second part of the discussion, Rosie and Mike talk about different music clubs. Look at questions 27 to 30 first. Listen carefully and answer questions 27 to 30.
Well, lastly, we looked at music, and this time we were really investigating the sort of small music clubs that offer things like folk or specialise in local bands.
So not musicals as such?
That's right.
We looked at three small music venues and we examined the quality of the entertainment and the venue and gave a ranking for these. A cross, meaning that the quality was poor, a tick, meaning it was okay, and two ticks for excellent. First of all, the Blues Club, which obviously specialises in blues music. This was a pretty small place and the seating was minimal, so we didn't give that a very good rating.
No, we don't recommend that one, really.
Then the Sansu, which plays a lot of South American music. It was a big place, very lively, good performers, so two ticks for that one. The Pier Hotel is a folk venue, a good place for local and up-and-coming folk artists to play. Not the best of venues, as it's in a basement and a bit dark, but the quality of the entertainment was reasonable and the lighting was very warm, so we felt it deserved an average rating. Now, finally, there's the Bald Rock Cafe, which features big rock bands and is pretty popular with students, and we enjoyed ourselves there as well, so top marks for that one.
And then, did you get any information from the students as to which of the clubs they preferred?
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part four.
Part four.
You will hear part of a lecture on wildlife. Listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Thousands of exotic plants and animals have been introduced into the British Isles over thousands of years. These newcomers compete with native species for resources and can also cause major changes in the wildlife and in the habitats of our countryside. The problem is not just British, of course, but global, and it has been going on for centuries. One good example of this I'd like to mention today is the European starling. The starling to us in the UK is a fairly ordinary little bird, about 12 inches long. In flight, it appears to be black or grey with tiny white spots. So it's a very ordinary-looking, almost dirty-looking bird. It nests in trees and buildings and can be found in the country and in towns. It travels in large flocks, leaving the nests in the morning and returning in the early evening. It feeds on insects and fruit. Its native range includes the British Isles and Finland, but it is also found in most of Europe and parts of Asia and Africa. In the British Isles and Finland, however, it has suffered a huge decline, and in these countries there is an effort to conserve the species. It is a different story in some of the places where it has been introduced. For example, the population in the USA is estimated at 170 million birds. Also, they are becoming a big problem in Australia and New Zealand. Starlings, as I have said, nest in trees, and it has been found that they are more aggressive than native species, native that is to Australia and New Zealand, when they are looking for nesting places. They therefore compete with native species for nests, and also they drive those species away from nests. So, this nest-building activity causes harm to native species, but also they are a nuisance to humans. They gather in large flocks of thousands of birds and feed together on commercial crops. This causes great financial damage to farmers. And they also make a mess, both in the town and the countryside. There is also the problem that starlings may carry diseases which affect both humans and other animals, although this has not been really confirmed and we are waiting for more work to be done on this. The question arises, what are we to do about foreign species which not only do damage to native species but interfere with human activity? We have three approaches in theory, but usually it is not a free choice between them. Usually we have to do the best we can and that money will allow. The best approach, of course, is prevention, and many countries have passed legislation which attempts to limit or prevent the arrival of non-native species in their countries. In particular, there are many international regulations on how and where ships may pick up and deposit water, and this is a major contribution to preventing the accidental transport of fish and organisms by ship, since accidental transport by ship is a frequent cause of fish and other creatures going from place to place. Ports also have special areas where water can be deposited, and many of them have treatment facilities to kill any foreign species that may establish themselves in their waters. For fish and organisms that live in water, these international regulations are useful, but obviously not all species can be dealt with in this way. Sometimes it is simply too late for prevention. Then we have to consider eradication or management. By management, I mean that we have to decide how best to live with the new creatures and how to keep their numbers down. However, this becomes not only a scientific question, it can be a matter of choice what population level of an invasive species we want to maintain. This choice involves costs. There is the cost of living with the species, and there is the cost of managing the species over time, and species management is usually a long-term business without any foreseeable end. However, there is not just the economic aspect to this question. We can also consider the ethical point. How should we treat animals which we have, sometimes deliberately, introduced into the environment? Is it permissible just to exterminate a number of them convenient to ourselves? The most important decision has to be made in the political forum, whatever considerations go into the making of that decision. These questions are relevant also to the approach of eradication, which is another option, but which does not have an encouraging history. Many attempts have been made to eradicate introduced species.
That is the end of part four.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.